Marjory Prime takes place in a future when grieving family members are comforted by pixel-generated avatars that resemble their loved ones. At the beginning of the movie, Marjory, an elderly widow played by Lois Smith, is having an affectionate conversation with Walter Prime, a replica of her deceased husband as he was 30 years before. He's played by John Hamm, and Marjory's daughter Tess is played by Gina Davis, her son-in-law John by Tim Robbins. In his review in New York Magazine, David Edelstein called Marjory Prime a sci-fi chamber drama that is beautiful, intense, and shivering with empathy, a transcendentally lovely work. It opens tomorrow at the Quad Cinema on 34 West 13th Street, and joining us now to talk about it are its director and screenwriter, Michael Almereyda, and its star, Lois Smith. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Michael, you've adapted this from a play by Jordan Harrison. When he came on our show to talk about his play, he told us he'd been inspired by watching his parents deal with his grandmother's Alzheimer's. What interested you in the material?
I was inspired by the play. I had heard Lois speak highly about it even before it was produced. And she talked with such excitement, I felt I had to chase her to Los Angeles and see the production. And afterwards, when we had drinks, even as I was watching the play, it was spinning in my head. There were ways I could see into it as a movie. I thought it could make a movie. And I was especially excited, just the greedy wish to work with Lois, who I'd known for a long time. And it felt like it was time to try to get together in this way.
So he saw one of the productions.
Yes, he saw the first one in Los Angeles.
You'd done this play in the theater with three different directors. What point in that sequence did you make the movie?
The movie was between the two stage productions, yes.
Has it changed a lot? Because movies always change plays, adaptations.
Oh, of course, yes.
Plays are longer, generally. They also have
intermissions. Not in this case, actually. It wasn't a very long play.
It's a trim play.
Yeah, a trim play. Indeed it is.
How has Marjory changed over the course of you're doing the play and then the movie with all these different directors?
In the film, she's a lot more mobile. I spent the production in both cases in a recliner for the most part. It takes place in a room in a house. And of course in the film, it's not that she's not mobile, but not for the purposes of the play. But in the film, I'm outside.
You even get to go swimming.
I've even been in the pool by the beach around the house, etc. So that was a big difference.
And Michael, when a play is adapted into film, things are often opened up. But, you know, despite the fact that she goes outside, to me, your version felt more intimate and confined.
I
don't mean that in a bad way.
It's not claustrophobic. At least we did our best to make it fluid and immediate. And I respected the structure of the play. I didn't want to overhaul it. I liked the characters and the language and the ideas. It is a very ingenious play. If Jordan were here, I would maybe embarrass him more with flattery, but he's a very cunning writer, and the concept of having a kind of ghost hologram of a person who isn't alive anymore sharing your life with you is a very powerful idea. It's very haunting to think of, and it's a future that's around the corner. It's within our lifetimes, I've been told. This is going to be something we have to think about actively and decide about. But more than that, it's also a way to talk about how we live our lives and how it's a science fiction film that's very much about humans. Yeah. And I embraced that by hiring the best actors I could, starting with Lois, and the cast was built around that. So it's different from the play in that movies can be more intimate. You're right up close.
It has the intensity of family members living closely together. It can't be a lot of moving around, it's a very verbal story.
That's true. It's conversation. It's people relating to each other and themselves.
Is it difficult to film continuous two or three person conversations and keep it moving?
Not if you have the right actors. And I was very lucky to have a great cameraman, cinematographer, that's the proper way to put it. And he's a very resourceful fellow named Sean Price Williams, who's been very busy, very active, and I was lucky to work with him.
Now, the film also allowed you to go back and forth in time in a way that you can't always do on the stage. What is a prime?
The prime is the artificial intelligence creature that the film invents.
Yeah. It's a funny word. Is it meant to imply something better than the original?
Oh, what an interesting thought. I remember in the Los Angeles production one time afterwards, a woman said, well, is it mathematical?
The prime number.
People would come up with, I haven't heard that one yet, though.
What do you think?
Well, you know,
of steak.
I was respectfully taking my cues from Jordan Harrison. Well, there's the embarrassing overlap with Amazon now too, but it almost fits because it's a product. The way Jordan outfitted his idea was, you know, if you have the idea of a hologram that can interact with humans, you could contrive a story that's about a blind date or a robbery. But he chose to make it about replacing or enhancing your memories. And so it becomes a kind of echo chamber, this creature.
At one point, Tessa, Marjorie's daughter, and John, her son-in-law, discuss the meaning of memory. Is all memory created, do you think? Become fictionalized over time?
Oh, sure, I guess, yes.
Because to some degree, that's the process here.
Yes.
You're about Marjorie's age. Do you ever struggle with memory?
Fortunately, I don't have Marjorie's kind of forgetting. Mine is names, especially last names. They just leave me and may then come back. But
my mother was an actress, and when I started doing this show and she knew I would be speaking to actors, she said, make me a promise. You'll never ask, how do you remember all those lines? Because she said, that's what we do. But then I've had actors come on without me asking that question and say, well, you know, as I've been getting older, sometimes that's a problem.
You know, I think maybe it's a different part of the brain, learning lines and forgetting people's last names. I seem to have more trouble with the names than I do with learning lines.
No one knew their lines better than Lois.
Well, the other people hadn't been living with a text for three years and playing the play from beginning to end, so I did have a bit of an advantage. Yes.
How much is Marjorie aware of? She seems to know that Walter is a prime because she alters his programming at times.
Indeed. I think she very much knows who she's talking to and enjoys it. As a matter of fact, one of the sort of balances to find, and I think I fought with at least one director about this a little bit, not this one, was...
This was a perfect match.
A perfect match. Was a finding how much of it was her enjoyment, because I think she's a woman who enjoys life and enjoys such challenges. But I think that was fun for her. Then there's the possibility of it being intimidating or confusing. And all of those things are true.
Well, she has to choose a prime of a certain age. Why did she choose a much younger version of Walter?
Why not?
Well, John Hamm is a very attractive man.
You get John Hamm this way. It's pretty good.
She does try to control things. Like she changes the movie they saw from My Best Friend's Wedding to Casablanca.
Yes. Why not change it? Yes. Control. Isn't that that is so much fun, isn't it? Well, suppose we did that. Talking to the prime, saying, well, if we do that, then it'll be true tomorrow.
So is it true that we all alter our memories even as we think about them?
Well, I did a minimum bit of research, and the standby bedrock formulation for me is the William James idea that memory isn't a filing cabinet or a well. It's quoted in the movie. It's a copy of a copy. It's like making a photocopy, and it gets more frayed, more distorted, more faded. And I believe that's scientifically true.
In this case, some decisions are being made on behalf of the person. Marjorie's daughter and son-in-law have decided to eliminate some painful incidents. Is it fair to do that on someone's behalf?
Who's to say? Isn't that an interesting question?
Because is a person just the sum of their memories, or are they altered to protect the person? And if that's the case, is that a kind of a violation of your past?
Oh, my goodness.
Well, you see, this movie actually opened up all sorts of philosophical thoughts.
Well, that's not so bad.
My guests are Lois Smith, the great actress, and Michael Amorata, the director-screenwriter behind a new film called Marjorie Prime, an adaptation of a play by Jordan Harrison. It opens tomorrow at the Quad Cinema on 34 West 13th Street. Michael, you're involved in a number of projects. I understand, I've read separately that you're doing a movie about Nikola Tesla and also an adaptation of White Noise.
Yes, The White Noise, that's Don DeLillo's great novel. He granted me the rights, and it happens he's a fan of Lois, as am I, and I've written, there's a part for her in that epic. And I'm also working on a biopic about Nikola Tesla with Ethan Hawke and Winona Ryder attached. So it's an ongoing process to get these movies made, but I'm excited about them, and I'm excited to work with Lois again.
So Lois will probably be a relief to give up Marjorie for a moment.
Yes, I'm going to give it up.
Although you're really playing two characters in a way. You're playing Marjorie and Marjorie Prime.
That's right.
How can we, the audience, see which one, know which one you're playing at any given time?
It's a twinkle in the eye.
I think it's clear. There's a moment of confusion when a prime appears and then another, but I think shortly it's clear.
Well, the primes seem to be much nicer to interact with because they listen so carefully and they've been programmed to want to please their
owners. They are programmed to listen, yes. And of course they're learning all the time. That's a great part of the fun. It seemed to me.
Of playing. Acting the prime and
yes,
watching the prime.
Yes, acting the prime, yes.
There's a scene where Marjorie Prime calls her daughter a name like Sweetie, and she says that her mother would never have done that.
Yes.
So the primes are kinder than humans.
Again, programmed, yes.
Let's talk about the importance of music in this movie and in terms of memories. Marjorie was a concert musician. How good was she?
Very good, yes. She's a little bit better in the film than in the play because Michael added a line, I believe, about... was that your line, Michael?
Tell me what it was.
Tess says you were better at the violin than I ever was at anything. Is that your line? Maybe it's Jordan's line.
I genuinely can't remember. I think I did a faithful job of impersonating him, but I'm not sure. But he based the play partly on his 90-year-old grandmother, who was a violinist, but not as good as Marjorie. And I took my cues from him all the way through. And the way music is used in the movie is again what separates it from the play. As much as I like the play, there's a way that the movie lifts off the ground a little because the music is very particular and very, I think, emotional. And it was, I took it as a guideline that music would be something Marjorie would remember even as her other memories are fading away, and that the music that drives the movie is in her head, is something she would have played and would be emotionally resonant or mirrored what she feels. So I was very lucky to have access to a piece called Wave Movements by Richard, I'm getting the names scrambled, Bryce Desner and Richard Reed Perry. And it was performed at the Met with the New York Philharmonic. And that was enhanced with original music by Mika Levy, who's a great composer. And these two strands weave throughout the movie, and I think they carry a lot of weight.
The point is also made several times in the film by the primes about how important pronouns are. Why are they significant in these contexts?
Because it's to keep the conversation present day, not to say you were when you're talking. No, you are. It's to keep it present.
No, I think it was more about not saying it. When they're referring
yes, that's
to the
true.
Primes.
That's right. Oh, you're right. You're absolutely
that,
right.
That,
you see, I'm already losing.
Marjorie Prime didn't want to be displaced or isolated as a thing.
Yeah.
She wanted her own personhood.
I was wondering throughout the film, whether it is possible to satisfy the need for something like a mother's love. Tess is still looking for a mother's love even after her mother dies. Is it possible to satisfy that need with a prime?
Of course not.
Right.
So really, I have nothing to look forward to in the future.
It seems to me that the kind of the suffering of life goes on even while the
comforts continue.
Whether or not you have a prime.
But the bottomless holes are still bottomless.
Yeah. Are you relieved, Lois, to not playing Marjorie anymore?
Or are you planning to do another? Oh no, I have not played Marjorie now for quite a while, but I'm still delighted to be living in it. Mm-hmm. I'm not about to play it again. I don't think.
Meanwhile, you'll be in one of Michael's other films.
I'll be in exactly.
And listeners should know that John Hamm, Lois Smith, and Michael Almereyda will be holding Q&As for the 6:35 p.m. and 7:05 p.m. shows on the 18th, that's tomorrow, at the Quad Cinemas. The film is Marjorie Prime. Great reviews. That has to make life a lot easier for you.
It doesn't hurt.
Does it mean more projects, Michael?
We shall see, but I'm grateful for the attention, and thanks for having us on.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
And
pleasure.
Thank you so much. Michael Almereyda is both the director and the screenwriter of Marjorie Prime, which opens tomorrow at the Quad Cinema at 34 West 13th Street. Lois Smith, of course, is one of our great actors. It's been such a pleasure having both of you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.